Hello and welcome to Independent Truths with Scott Atlas. I'm your host. This is my new show that brings a uniquely rational perspective to the important issues facing society today. Today's guest, I'm excited to say, is Professor John Ioannidis of Stanford University School of Medicine. Dr. Ioannidis is a professor of medicine in the Stanford Prevention Research Center and professor of epidemiology. John and I will have a hopefully illuminating conversation about the pandemic, what happened in the early days, how our experts failed the American people, and what was revealed and how to fix science itself. Thanks for joining us. Stay tuned. Well, my guest today, I want to welcome Dr. John Ioannidis. John is a professor of medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine in the Stanford Prevention Research Center and a professor of epidemiology and population health. He has a long list of accolades. I won't go through all of them. His primary accolade to me is that he was so helpful to me during the pandemic, advising me very frequently, no matter where he was in the world. John's also the co-director of the Meta Research Innovation Center at Stanford, which is described on their website as a, quote, research to action center dedicated to finding ways to improve the validity and transparency of scientific research, unquote. And this is very important to the approach that John has brought in his entire career to science. In fact, my favorite and perhaps very revealing quotation of John is found on his own Stanford website profile, where he writes, quote, "I love to be constantly reminded that I know next to nothing," unquote. He happens to be one of those highly cited scientists in the world. His 2005 paper called "Why Most Published Research Findings Are False" was the most accessed article in the history of the Public Library of Science as of 2020, with more than 3 million views. And in that seminal paper, he shows that most published findings are false positives and cannot be replicated. And I think that's a great place to introduce John. Welcome, John. I'm happy to see you again.
Thank you for the very kind invitation, Scott. I really look forward to the day that we meet in person at last.
Yes, this has been a long sort of a period of separation because both of us travel quite a bit, and the pandemic was, as it was for everyone, quite complicated. Let's start, if I can, from the beginning sort of the pandemic. And when I say the beginning, I'm going to start with what you wrote, which I think is the most important and most insightful paper in the early days, which was your publication in the publication called STAT on March 17th, 2020, in which you warned about this evolving into what you called a once-in-a-century evidence fiasco. Can you explain what was going on at that time and what your thinking was?
I think that at that time, we knew very little. What we knew was that we were facing a major crisis that could have repercussions, both because of the pandemic that was due to a new virus that we knew very little about, and also because of the measures that we were taking, trying to do our best to deal with that virus. I think that when you have a major crisis with potential major repercussions, you want to make sure that you have the best data, that you try to not cut corners in collecting data. You try to respond immediately. You don't wait for data. You need to make decisions, obviously, immediately. You have a major threat, but you need to go ahead and collect the best evidence to be able to guide you in decisions that may affect millions and billions of people. There were millions of lives at threat from the virus itself, and there was the whole world at threat based on our response. So I was just one among many people who were concerned. And I think that that was not so unique. It was something that everybody was in a state of uncertainty. And when you have uncertainty, science is the best thing that you can have if you can get it to work and get the evidence in place promptly.
Right. And I think, we met as being called independently to testify, actually, even though we're both at Stanford, we didn't know each other because Stanford's sort of a big place with a lot of separate places where people work. And we happened to meet as we were both called to testify to the Senate in the spring of 2020. And it was really fascinating how we said virtually the same thing to the Senate, which was, in my view, that first, we weren't considering that the World Health Organization infection fatality rate was highly likely to be wrong because they were only talking about people who were sick enough to go to the doctor as the bottom of that fraction of people who could die, instead of the fact that, as in almost all respiratory viruses, there's a lot of people infected that are not sick enough to go to the doctor or that may or may not even know they're infected. But also that the policies were sort of contrary to common sense, since, as in most viruses, although not all, you could easily say who was likely to be the high risk. And instead of focusing on protecting them, there was a very draconian and unprecedented policy. And, it all did stem from this sort of reactive policy that was implemented without really knowing the validity of the data. And I think this is what was frightening. Was it unprecedented in terms, not just the draconian nature of the policy, John, but the sort of assumption of something being proven when it really was based on very flimsy or improper data?
I think that people threw a very large number of measures against the pandemic, trying to do their best. The background, I believe, was mostly well-intentioned. Of course, there might have been some who had conflicts of interest and some stakeholders who tried to benefit out of the crisis. But I believe that most people who were involved had the best intentions. They wanted to save lives. They wanted to make sure that we have the least impact from such a big threat. However, there's each measure that is being taken. There is the possibility of harming people, even though you try to offer them the best. And I think that many of the restrictive measures made the situation very unfavorable for the most disadvantaged segments of the population. It created a lot of problem for children. It really damaged education. It created a major burden of mental health on top of the mental health problem that is caused just by knowing that there's a lethal virus circulating in the community. And it created lots of other secondary ripple effects that I think we will be seeing their impact even in the longer term. We haven't seen the full story yet. And I do hope that we manage to stop these repercussions even now. So yes, it was not an easy process of decision making. And I think that that people were struggling. Some people were mostly concerned about how to minimize transmission, and others were concerned about the whole picture, not just the virus, but all the other repercussions that one could get from the virus plus the measures being taken. There were differences of opinion in terms of how closely one should track the pandemic, for example, how intensively testing should be performed. I was among those who were pretty fond of testing because I wanted to have eyes on the virus, and I also wanted systematic testing so that we know exactly where the virus is hitting and how it is spreading, based on our early studies that we did at Stanford and several other teams did that. We showed that there's many people being infected who don't realize that they're infected. There's a lot of asymptomatic infection. Apparently, there was also asymptomatic transmission in order to have so many people infected without even noticing. So I felt that we needed to have close eyes on the virus do our best, certainly protect those who were at high risk because for them, infection could be devastating, and try to maintain normality as much as possible and not create extra problems. So it was a balancing act. And I think that this is where tension arose between people who had perhaps not very dissimilar perspectives, but they put more emphasis and more priority on one side of the equation rather than the other.
Yes, and I think a couple things I'd like to emphasize here is that, yes, I do agree with you. People were all well-intentioned. I don't think that is the issue, but I do think there were some fundamental problems with the way the policies were designed to ignore or underemphasize the totality of health and the impact of the policies, and rather so overwhelmingly focus on stopping the single virus itself. And I do think, I agree that people didn't understand the virus completely. That's clear. But what we did know were two things. Number one, the standard pandemic management that was what was not for lockdowns, and in fact emphasized the danger and the problems, the harms of total society lockdown. This was known and understood, I think, in the community, but also in the scientific community. But also these things were sort of anticipatable. They were predictable. And you and I and others, Sunetra Gupta and many others, pointed out that when you have severe isolation, you are really harming, and not to mention closing schools, you're going to harm children and the most vulnerable of society, the lower income families, the single parent families, how about, you know, children with disabilities, all kinds of things were very predictable. So I agree, we didn't know a lot about the virus, but we didn't know zero. We knew fundamental biology, we knew fundamental aspects of infection protection after having a virus. I mean, and I think this is one of the things that struck me was that many people were simply throwing up their arms and discarding not just decades, but perhaps centuries or more of knowledge about basic infection and the response to infection. So this was very difficult to watch. I agree with you. We haven't even seen most at all of the harms, particularly of our younger generation, from the lockdowns. Now, I think that the bigger problems are not the pandemic and the virus, but really what's been, what do we do from now on? I think this is very important because, and I'd like to hear your comments on what this has done to the public's trust of experts, trust of credentialed people, trust of public health guidance itself, and even more fundamentally, trust of science. I think this is very worrisome, what's happening in my mind. I'd like to hear your comments on that.
This is a very interesting perspective. I think that it was a major crash test for science, what we witnessed. And in some regards, I think that science was very successful. For example, developing vaccines that were pretty effective for decreasing the number of deaths, at least in record time. I think that most people would not expect that we would have effective vaccines, even though they would not stop transmission. At least I think that they did save lives based on their effects on heart outcomes. Yes. I think that we saw massive mobilization of scientists. We have published the analysis that show that even by early mid 2021, we already have more than 700,000 scientists authoring papers on COVID-19. And by now we have more than 500,000 scientific papers published on COVID-19. And all 174 fields of science inquiry had some scientists who were experts in these fields who focused on COVID-19. And this is entirely unprecedented. So we saw that the scientific community did care, did get mobilized, did have some major successes. At the same time, I think that there was a problem with science communication. And I'm not saying this to blame anyone. I can blame myself. At least I feel very much unprepared to be in an environment that was heavily politicized, highly polarized, very partisan, where people were using science or misusing science as a weapon to support specific ideologies or perspectives that were not necessarily scientific or oriented towards public health goals.
Yeah, I can second
One
that if I can interrupt.
The argument that public health had avoided us.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that was shocking to me. I think that the entire hijacking of science to be put into some sort of a political realm, none of us, I don't think, were prepared for this sort of reaction.
I think that was the sad part. And I think that once we get into a polarized environment, we miss the opportunity to have the entire community, the entire population really follow in the scientific effort, in the public health effort. In public health, we really want participation of citizens. We want citizens to be convinced that leadership, that public health officers, that scientists are doing their best for everyone, not just for the privileged, not just for people belonging to one party, not just for people belonging to one sect or trusting one ideology, but everyone. And I felt that by immersing science into that partisan type of debates, many people lost their faith and their trust in science. I think faith is the wrong word because science is not dogma, but they lost their trust. I think that they felt that science may belong to their opponents, to their ideological opponents, to people who expect to gain out of this. And I think that was clearly a misrepresentation because amazing scientists fought in that effort. And as I said from the very beginning, talk with everyone. I talked with you. I talked with many other people who had completely opposite opinions to what you had, and probably I talked far more with them. And I wanted to learn. I wanted to find out, what do other people who are better than me, who are wiser than me, who have more data than I do, who have better perspectives, can tell me about what is the best way to deal with this crisis? I think that maximizing exposure to different opinions, to different perspectives, to different viewpoints from well-intentioned people is the way to make progress and to really find what is the best solution. And to show to the community that this is not really a quarrel, this is not really people for points from each other. This is about trying to save lives, trying to help people, trying to help the community, trying to help everyone, and doing the best to help everyone, especially those who are disadvantaged. I think a major, major problem was that the disadvantaged became more disadvantaged. The early data that we have based on deaths, according to both educational and income and social stratification, suggests that really we saw tremendous gradient of burden of disease and fatalities based on who was disadvantaged. People who were disadvantaged became even more disadvantaged.
Absolutely. I mean, this is really one of the great tragedies of the pandemic management was that the result of the policies was very dependent and very different on different socioeconomic classes. And I think this is really, this will go down as a historic, almost sin about the way the pandemic was managed, where lower income people, the poor, and the otherwise disadvantaged populations were tremendously harmed by the policies themselves. We're not talking about the virus itself here. We're talking about the policies were far more harmful to them than they were to the affluent, to the so-called elites. And I think this is really a historic lesson to learn, hopefully. The other thing I want to emphasize is what you said, which is there is no such thing really as science without the free exchange of ideas. There's no such thing as critical thinking without considering more than one viewpoint. But the way we arrive at scientific truths, as you clearly know, is by going through hypothesis testing, talking to people and looking at data that differs from your original viewpoint. And when we're in this with the intent to save lives, I mean, that's exactly why I went to Washington. People were dying and there were some wrong policies in place for months. I think the scientific process is so dependent on the free exchange of ideas. And this is where not only the journals, I think, failed here because they were editorialized quite a bit, in my view, unprecedented, but also the university professors, the university campuses, the medical schools became highly politicized. And there is no place in science for politics, period. And we need to get back to that. So we are working on this. As you know, I have co-founded myself with Martin Kulldorff and Jay Bhattacharya, an Academy for Science and Freedom, to help get science back to depoliticized, objective, and really the free exchange of ideas. And actually, I'm saying this partly because I hope you will be involved in that, and I look forward to working with you. What is just like to touch on how you, of course, have honorary professorships all over the world. And that's part of the reason why you're traveling so much. I'm just curious what you've noticed, if anything, that differs from the United States and the places in mainly Europe that you travel in terms of the scientific community and the reaction to these issues that arose from the pandemic management about science itself. Have you noticed anything different in the way the scientific community in Europe talks about this?
I think that the crisis was global, and therefore also the crisis within the scientific community was also global, but each country had its own characteristics and its own tensions and its own debates. And of course, there were local political overtones. So you could see the same positions being supported by right-wing parties in one country and by left-wing parties in another country, just depending on who had endorsed a specific package of policies. So it was very interesting for me having that multinational perspective to see that really there was no ownership of political ideology of science, which is very good,
yes.
Of course, because mostly it an opportunistic setting. You know, people were trying to make the best out of the situation. And I think that this led to some very weird situations in terms of the interface between science and politics and media and social media. I think it's hard to say which country did best eventually. If you look at excess death calculations, they depend on how exactly you run the numbers and what is the comparator years, for example, and what you expect to see in a projection move. The U.S., we did very poorly. Many countries did extremely well. A large number of countries had the same or fewer deaths. If you look at excess deaths in 2020 to 2022, compared to the 3 years pre-pandemic. That includes practically all Scandinavian countries, including Sweden, and also Australia and New Zealand and South Korea and several others. Conversely, the US did very poorly. It was among the worst in terms of excess deaths. We have about 1 million excess deaths, and we have a lot of excess deaths in young populations, which to me needs to be seen in the context of also what was happening for a very long time in our country. We have had major problems with public health, with supporting or not supporting disadvantaged populations, with lifestyle problems, huge proportion of the population having obesity that we were not doing anything about, a huge number of people who have no insurance, huge number of people who are are not privileged. They're kind of second-class citizens, unfortunately, and they were very heavily hit by the pandemic. So in a way, we had seen a problem with public health in our country for 10 years. The mortality data, the slope of improving life expectancy was almost flat in the U.S. for 10 years, while it was improving markedly in practically every other high-income country. And then in the pandemic, we saw a big hit with a major increase compared to other countries that, as I mentioned, had either no impact compared to pre-pandemic years or a very small or modest impact compared to what we saw in the U.S. So I think it's difficult to claim that that was due to a specific component of the response. I think that it's an X-ray of the malfunction of an entire system, of an entire health system, of an entire public health approach, both acutely and chronically. We need to pay more attention because these are problems that don't go away when the virus goes away or when the virus becomes less aggressive with background natural immunity and with vaccinations. There are problems that stay with us. You know, the drug overdose, the fact that we have so many people who have very poor access to care, the fact that we have so many people who have chronic diseases because of obesity. We still have a substantial number of people who are smoking. We have major problems that go way beyond the virus, and I'm hating people who are second-class citizens, and they don't deserve that treatment. We need to take care of all these people who really suffered during the pandemic and are going to suffer even more after the pandemic unless we fix things.
Yes, I think these are very good points. It's very complicated to tease out what happened and why in terms of the results, but we can say something very obvious here, which is that the proportion of population in the United States with lifestyle associated risk factors, and in this case, the number one risk factor for poor outcome from this virus was obesity and diabetes, which of course go hand in hand in many cases. I think the extraordinary percentage of people with this one single risk factor, obesity in the United States, was a big setup for this virus. And, you know, unfortunately, we saw the result of that. I think there's a lot of very complex things that will probably be impossible to sort out. But we can say for sure that the U.S. did poorly over two administrations. This has nothing to do with politics. And many countries that were criticized for their management, like Sweden, did far better. So in that vein, you know, we can leave this. Really want to appreciate your time, John. And I think we can conclude by saying something that just like a lot of your career and research has shown, we have a lot to learn about doing good research and about the conclusions we can make, because things are quite complicated. And when things are complicated, we better do our best to have very solid data and data analysis. But with that, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy travels to join me today. It was great seeing you, at least virtually.
Thanks, Scott. And again, I think that one day we will meet in person at last.
Yes.
Sorry it hasn't happened for so many years on campus.
Okay, great talking to you, John. Thank you again. Thank you for listening to today's Independent Truths with Scott Atlas. I want to thank John Ioannidis for being our special guest today. I hope you found it as interesting as I did. If you want to find out more about John, you'll have to follow the research because he's so smart he doesn't use social media. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Independent Truths, on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, Google, and anywhere else that you're listening to podcasts these days. And I'll see you next time.